Hello and welcome to another edition of the Ducks Confidential Podcast. I'm James Crepia, joined, as always, by Ryan Clark, and we'll be getting into a variety of things, as it's been a minute since we last joined you, but that was mainly due to just some logistical things on our end and whatnot. But bottom line, obviously the basketball seasons have concluded. The transfer portal is a humming and will continue to be across the country. In college basketball, men's and women's college basketball, and of course, spring football practice very much underway. And that is where we'll start. We will get to basketball, but since we are in quite literally the midst of spring football, and believe it or not, actually nearing the midpoint of spring football, even though the Ducks have all three of their spring scrimmages still to come. The first on this Saturday, as we record here on Wednesday afternoon, and of course, the spring game on the 27th. So the next couple of Saturdays, they'll have some scrimmages, and of course, with the culmination being the spring game. But Ryan, in terms of what we've heard so far, I don't want to go by what we've seen, because as we all know, as many of the fan knows, and for those who do not, we don't usually get to see very much. That's not a complaint. That's just reality by way of practice. Not a lot necessarily to glean there. But in terms of what we have heard from both Dan Lanning and his staff and players so far over the last week or so, since the Ducks got back from spring break and whatnot, what has stood out to you? Of course, we'll get into the running backs coach change separately, but outside of the Carlos Lachlan to Rashad Samples transition that's coming and is going on, and we have yet to hear from running back, so we'll get to that. But that aside, what else has stood out to you from spring practice and what we've heard from coaches and players thus far?
Yeah, I mean, setting aside Lachlan and cookie emoji gate or whatever you want to call the last 24 hours in his discussion, now obviously him joining up with Ohio State, but it was nice yesterday to hear from Dylan Gabriel for the first time. I think that, you know, you can really hear and sort of feel the 5 years of, you know, experience in college football with a guy like that, right? You know, obviously being from Hawaii, there's sort of the easygoing lifestyle that's built in, but he's somebody that really does seem easygoing and has an interesting personality, and is someone that I think Duck fans are going to be excited to get to know this year. You know, they had the sort of Bo Nix rental for a couple of years, and that was a lot of fun for them to get to know him, his personality, his family. And I think that, you know, Dylan Gabriel is somebody that has an opportunity to endear himself to Oregon fans this year, particularly if he has the kind of success on the field that a lot of experts around college football think he will have. But it was nice to speak to him yesterday. Good to hear from Dan Lanning, obviously, after an eventful offseason for him, to hear from his staff throughout spring football so far, starting to in many ways, and you know, this can veer into cliche at times, but to sort of lay out the vision for the program, as or program as some may pronounce it, as they enter this third year. So it's been an interesting couple of weeks, you know, for me getting back from vacation. Obviously I was disappearing overseas for the start of everything this spring, but came back in time for these official practices, and you know, it's been good to hear from people in the program and to get to know some new faces, while also obviously seeing how the returners are adjusting to things. So
yeah, and certainly again, to your point, that Dylan Gabriel will certainly, I think, endear himself to Oregon fans over time. Yes, we did hear from him for the first time yesterday, and we'll have lots from that conversation and prior conversations with members of the staff and players in terms of you know, what they've had to say about each other, about him, about how he's handled things so far in spring practice, about for the players who have worked out with him separately, both really very early in his time upon arriving at Oregon back in January, and including during spring break, multiple receivers.
Yeah, he made a serious effort on that. Yeah. Like he genuinely went out of his way, which, you know, a guy that's transferring in that is sort of out for his own situation and trying to up his draft stock or whatever selfish motivation one might have. They aren't doing stuff like that. So, you know, he seems very bought into the program in general, just based on what he said and what he's done.
Yeah, and it's one thing to do it on your own and put in time, and that's certainly admirable, commendable, et cetera. So it's level of commitment, seriousness, professionalism, et cetera, et cetera. But to go out and not just work on your own, as one might do, with private coaches, as many quarterbacks do, but it is another thing to bring with you your receivers, and not just one and not just two, but a gaggle of receivers for a weekend or for multiple days during spring break. That's different. That's different because, you know, going down to work with a private quarterback coach and throw the ball around, believe me, you can find receivers wherever it is that you're going, whether it was Bo going to work in South Alabama, in Gulf Shores, or it's Dylan working in Southern California. You know, they can find some receivers, whether they're former college players, current college players, Division II guys, high school guys, whatever the case is. You can find people to go catch the ball for you. But when you bring in your own guys, particularly guys who you're trying to quickly develop chemistry with, develop relationships with on and off the field, and the like, that speaks volumes. That is something that's different. Now, some of that comes with, yeah, he's a six-year guy, undoubtedly, but that speaks to, you know, how he goes about his business, and these are things that are not necessarily new for Dylan Gabriel simply because he has come to Oregon, but it is something he has done in his first, call what it is, sitting here, ironically enough, on April 10th, pretty much 100 days since he's arrived and been at the university, more or less, since
first 100 days, a sort of presidential situation for
yeah,
Mr.
Draw the
Gabriel.
Analogy, but like that's
who knows,
it.
maybe by the time fall rolls around and they're a few games into that Big Ten schedule, maybe people will be campaigning for him to be president. We'll see.
I think they'll suffice for the Heisman
they'll take that.
They'll go for that. But no, like I say, that stands out. You know, those kinds of actions stand out. And then you get into the words and the poise and the presence of, you know, what does, you know, you don't win a press conference as a player or a coach per se, but, you know, it comes off that you're talking to somebody who's not just, you know, who's been around the block, who's played very well, and who's been in the spot before. And that comes across. And we'll be hearing from Dante Moore as well. And to be clear, like, no, we're not making and passing all kinds of judgments one way or the other, but yeah, call it what it is. Dylan Gabriel came here to be the starting quarterback. And,
yeah.
I mean, that's just what it is. And everything that he's done so far off the field and in these moments, like I say, and working with teammates has illustrated that. And I don't think there's really much debate or discussion to be had. That doesn't mean that things can't be competitive in a practice. That doesn't mean that Dante Moore isn't also a very, very talented player. But you brought in a sixth-year senior who's thrown for thousands upon thousands of yards and was one of the better quarterbacks in college football last year and was the top quarterback in the transfer portal for a reason. Yeah. Let's just call it what it is. And Dante previously has talked about, you know, we'll hear from him in the not-too-distant future, but he has previously spoken of wanting to be developed and the like. And this year certainly would serve as an opportunity, if he is the backup to Dylan, to develop at a pace to probably still play a significant number of games, maybe even more than four games in redshirting. Because if everything goes according to plan, Oregon is going to be at a significant advantage against many of the teams on its schedule. So there will probably be ample opportunities for a backup quarterback to play and not just play at, you know, the end of a fourth quarter kind of thing. But that's for, you know, months and months and months from now. For now, for a first conversation with Dylan, certainly a lot of those things stood out. One other thing that stood out to me, and again, this is good, bad, or otherwise, it just is. You know, Dylan Gabriel is not 6'5". I mean, that you know that already.
yeah.
Look,
he was in socks. To be fair,
he was. I will say, in the right pair of shoes, I could probably embellish myself to be 6 foot tall. Okay, in the exact right pair, maybe
yeah,
I could stretch.
I've been 5'11 and like 3/4 for basically my whole life.
I've I'm probably generously listed at 5'11", probably closer to the 5'10" and change. Okay. I am taller than Dylan Gabriel. Now, that does not mean one thing or another. I'm not saying anything about ability to play or how that relates to NFL or anything else. I'm just saying, if you know nothing else, if you are a casual fan and you have looked at and seen he was listed at 6 foot tall at UCF, which should not surprise you, given that maybe certain programs may embellish some measurements, and then seen him listed at 5'11" at Oklahoma, in cleats and a helmet, I have no doubt that Dylan might be able to stretch to that point. But flat-footed, no, he was not. But be that as it may, that, you know, upon first meeting him, you know, again, knowing that he's not somebody who's going to tower over you like a Justin Herbert did, it did strike me that, like, oh, okay, yes, he probably is about 5'10-ish, maybe even 5'9". Does that mean anything good, bad, or otherwise? No. Just means that he's not the prototypical, you know, 6'3", 6'4".
It's an observation.
It's an observation, yes. And for that matter, probably helps a little bit in his mobility and escapability, given his size, and, you know, running is a significant part of his game. And escaping the pocket is a significant part of his game. And not for nothing, being a 6'4" quarterback may or may not help you in that regard. So observationally, again, he's built the way he is from a physical standpoint, but in terms of mentally and dealing with media and whatever in our initial conversation with him yesterday, some of those things that some of the observations that we had had. Some others so far, obviously they've brought in almost all of their transfers at this point, just Brandon Johnson from Duke. The safety from Duke yet to arrive. Now, that'll be happening later on because he has to finish up academics at Duke before getting here. But otherwise, everybody else is here. Evan Stewart and Jabbar Muhammad arriving after spring break, which was, I don't know, for some, I can't keep track in the Twitterverse of who knows what they're talking about and who doesn't. More often than not, it's the latter. But for some people, I don't know, that was apparently surprising that players who didn't even commit to Oregon until winter quarter had been well underway. We're not here yet, but be that as it may, they're here now. And so far in the, you know, very brief time that they've been here, Evan Stewart sounds like he's already been making a couple of plays and making a very, very quick and early first impression about the kind of athleticism that
he's already heard more rumblings maybe than one might expect in the sort of tight quarters that is those practices. Now, there also is motivation, obviously, to hype up somebody like Evan, who, you know, is a guy that, you know, comes in with a lot of potential and a lot of track record of success, right? He's a guy that one would expect to be the number one receiver this year and to put up big numbers and be a go-to guy for Dylan.
Yeah, I have a feeling that but not just by the end of spring, but in general, look, this is a receiving core that is basically a split between older, experienced, proven players, many of them transfers, and a lot of freshmen. And the room is basically split almost down the middle in that regard. Now, Evan Stewart is one of those transfers. He's a junior by eligibility purposes. So he comes in, you already have Tez coming off, you know, an 1,100-yard season, and you know what you got there. And obviously, Garrett Bryant Jr., and Trayshawn Holden are coming back, transfers from a year ago. So they're established by way of at the top of the depth chart, seemingly, that they have, yes, experienced and proven players. There is a influx of freshmen where it will be interesting to see throughout the rest of spring who does stand out and who raises their game to be in the 5 and 6 lines. On the two deep, who get to be the number twos at their respective positions. That's not something we're going to get a public declaration about or anything, but I think it becomes pretty obvious and apparent in the spring game by the way the roster is composed and who, you know, gets reps accordingly. But hearing a lot about Jurion Dickey as well, we had heard that during bowl practice that, hey, he's really taking it up a notch now with the time that was there ahead of the Fiesta Bowl, and he is only built upon that even more. And to hear from all the receivers in particular, but hearing from Tez Johnson and then hearing from Junior Adams, receivers coach, that, yeah, here's a guy who we know he came in last year and was coming off an injury, and he was behind, and he was struggling, and it was tough for him to try to learn the playbook real quick because the proverbial drinking out of a fire hose and coming in late and every which other coming in at the normal time, which is now late in college football, arriving in the summer. And to then, by the end of the season, be healthy, know what you're doing, and to be able to go out there and play a little bit, got a little bit of run in the bowl game, a little bit. But this is the former five-star who now seemingly, you know, both off the field in the meeting room, helping teach younger players, where he was, this is his first spring. He wasn't here a year ago. And learning was something that was, you know, a challenge for him at first, not, you know, mainly from just the speed of things. Now he's bringing along younger guys less than a year in his first spring. That those are the kinds of things you want to hear as a fan, that, oh yeah, by the way, you know, this is not a player who, it's not because of lack of talent or lack of desire or want to or work ethic. He was just coming in off the injury and it was what it was. But now he's putting himself in position to make plays and is making plays and is helping bring along the rest of the younger guys in a room. That's significant. That's enormous. So when we're talking about, yes, there are those four proven commodities who are transfers, who come in, who have track records, who've produced previously both here and elsewhere, who will join them. Jurion Dickey seems like he's absolutely going to be one of those guys. And then it becomes, who else is in there? Is it Kyle Casper or Justice Lowe, who are, you know, redshirt sophomores in their own right? Or is it one of the four freshmen who've arrived, who are all obviously pretty highly touted guys in their own regard? So one of the many positions that there's intrigue, most certainly in terms of what the roster will look like and what the rest of spring and the offseason will look like in terms of personnel. But it's probably one of the few of them in terms of offense, because running backs, while there's a coach change we'll get to in a moment, in quarterback, yes, it's a restock and that obviously draws attention. I think there's less drama, I think, at quarterback when you really think about it than I think some would like to create, simply because, well, you're losing a terrific quarterback in Bo Nix, and what are you going to do? Well, I think what Oregon is going to do is pretty clear at the quarterback position. Running back, they return guys. Yes, they lose a Bucky Irving, but they return guys. Receiver, they lose Troy Franklin. They return significant players, but bring in a lot of new, you know, really talented young guys. Offensive line, yes, they do lose two guys, including Jackson Powers Johnson, who's the best center in the country. But they have answers. They have answers immediately. So there's a reason why Oregon is considered to be, at this point in all of these early rankings and betting markets and the like, to be projected to be one of the best teams in the Big Ten, if not the country, because they do have all these answers on offense. Now, to the running back position, which we'll get to, the move from Carlos Lachlan, who leaves to go to Ohio State, where he spoke for the first time earlier today, and moving on to Rashad Samples from Arizona State. He comes into Oregon staff, and we're awaiting contract details and the like, but he is on staff, and he was at practice on Tuesday. Your thoughts, Ryan, on the move that is and was, and what this could mean to the running back room and recruiting and the like?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Lachlan is a major loss and somebody that had a great deal of success in that position, coached a lot of great running backs in his time at Oregon. But I think that you could do a lot worse than Rashad Samples, right? And I don't just say that as an Arizona State University alum. That is that is a guy that, you know, under Kenny Dillingham at ASU, was integral to a lot of what they did on the recruiting front. And you see it even this week with a lot of different guys being asked about Rashad around ASU. There's no ill will. There's no silent next questioning of anything. That's a guy that garnered a lot of respect around Tempe and played an integral role for Kenny Dillingham. So on the recruiting front, I think Samples, one could argue, might bring even more on in that and his connections to Texas and everything else than he will in terms of you know, leading a running back room that has a lot of experience that, you know, I believe Dan Lanning was asked about that sort of transition, the idea that the running back room has so much experience that Samples doesn't have to come in and set the tone on day one. He can be part of a collaborative experience in the running back room. So I think it's a great hire, frankly, to bring Rashad in, and we'll see how it impacts the sort of foundation that Lanning and his staff have set on that front. But you know, obviously we'll see how things go for Lachlan alongside old friend Chip Kelly over at Ohio State. So
yeah, I think ultimately that there's a bit, you know, there is a business side to all of this, and again, it gets complicated when it happens at the time that it does, and there's certainly things that can be revisited in the future. And asked Dan about that at the time, you know, last week when right after Lachlan had left for Ohio State, of do you look to revisit the timing of the buyout clauses in assistant coach contracts to better prevent and curb movement during the course of spring practice, because the buyouts were for all the assistants, not just for Carlos Lachlan, for all the assistants, the buyouts were more significant up until April 1st and then came down basically almost across the board. I think Will Stein may have a slightly different structure, but bottom line, basically across the board to 50% from 100% of their remaining salaries after April 1st up until some point off into the future, usually until the end of this current contract year, which would be after January of 25. And, you know, Dan didn't say yes or no to that. He just said, you know, he's more focused on guys who want to be here and the like, et cetera. And that's all fine and well and good. But to the business side element of it, yeah, when you lose an assistant on the day that the buyout changes, and, you know, there were overtures from other places before that, and part of what prevented his departure earlier was a very prohibitive buyout. And then you go, well, are you better off making the buyout the more, you know, more prohibitive at least through May 1st? Or basically, does April 1st make sense for the buyout aspect of things and the business element of it all?
Would you rather? What did the communications look like behind the scenes, right, too, or lack thereof?
Right. And basically, would you rather have the buyout be prohibitive up until March 1st? And then, hey, look, if you want to go, go. And then we can make change. Whoever the institution is, we could talk about any school could want this. School loses an assistant in March or, you know, early March. Okay, well, spring practice may or may not have started depending on the school. Arizona State being a place, one of a couple that actually starts a little bit earlier. But okay, whatever. Whether spring practice has started or not, it probably hasn't, especially at Oregon, it hasn't. So therefore, better able to make a hire and still have continuity. They get, you know, hit the ground running. They are not missing X number of practices. They're able to learn personnel and the like. And, you know, you can go from there. Or do you want to push the date back further so that to say, keep everybody, or better, have a better chance to keep everybody. And by the time you get to May 1st, quite frankly, barring something totally like way, way, way unusual and cataclysmic, you're not going to have a Power Four coaching staff that has a coaching opening. The NFL's done. Their coaching staffs are set. The draft is done. So coaching in that realm is set. There's no more movement. Across college football, most of the coaching movement happens in December and January. The fact that a couple of moves were still to be had at this juncture, why did this series of dominoes occur? Because Jim Harbaugh left Michigan to go to the Chargers after the championship game. And then Sharon Moore moved up. And then they had to make moves. And then they hired Alford from Ohio State. And that happened when it did in March. And Ohio State has an opening all of a sudden, later than it anticipated having an opening, certainly. And then all of a sudden, they've got to fill a job, and it goes from there. But it all traces back to, yeah, because Jim Harbaugh was coaching in the national championship game in the middle of January. And even though most everybody expected him to leave, you know, how Sharon Moore was going to fill out Michigan staff and the ripple effects thereafter was how and why we got to this point.
Well, so Oregon fans can blame Jim Harbaugh then.
There you go. But truly, like, how do you better curb that in an expanded playoff world to where the national championship is going to be as late, if not later, in the future? Well, either have assistant coach contracts where the buyouts are prohibitive up until an earlier date and say, again, if you want to go on, okay, and we'll be better able to adjust accordingly, or to have it so prohibitive later and say, if you're going to go and get our guy before it's conducive to us, you're going to pay a king's ransom to do that. And that's just going to, you know, so basically, if you're committed to a staff, you're committed to a staff, period. And it's going to be bordering on the impossible for you to leave. So if you're making the commitment, you're committed. This is what the contract says. And if you're going to get out and somebody's going to come along, not only are they going to have to pay you, they're going to have to pay us a gargantuan sum of money. That's the business element to it all. And I'm sure Carlos Lachlan got paid well to go to Ohio State, and good for him. And we'll see exactly, we'll wait the contract details on Rashad Samples, but I'd heard from multiple avenues now that he was in line to make. He had made $500,000 at ASU last year and had signed a contract extension with a raise to $600,000 for the upcoming year. Lachlan had signed an extension for $400,000 at Oregon. So, well, you know, we can surmise in the interim, but clearly, between what Lachlan was making, what Samples was due to make, and the $360,000-ish in change that Ohio State paid Oregon for Lachlan's buyout, I think you can see where Samples' contract is likely to end up. And again, we'll get those details in the days ahead exactly what it ended up being.
Point of one total, one Damian Martinez, basically, is the exchange rate.
That's the new
rate.
Unit of measure, allegedly and reportedly on that side of things.
Yes, yeah. Of course.
And look, there is a business side element to it all. Now it gets into, the back and forth, and Lachlan talking for the first time today to Ohio State media. So it came up in a couple of questions in Columbus about the soft batch cookie reference that he had made while at Oregon, a year or so ago. Talking about, and then saying, well, it wasn't really about the transfer portal and players transferring. It was about a mindset and a mentality more so than that. You go, well, okay, but what you said nearly a year ago to the day when you first made this remark and reference was that there is a bakery for said soft batch cookies, and it's called the transfer portal. So that's his words.
Yes.
And look, at the time, Oregon fans, as Ohio State fans are now, literally eating it up, loving it. That's great. Wonderful. And it doesn't matter whether it is or it isn't. This is college football. This is part of it. You ask an NFL fan, even the most diehard of NFL fans, who their running backs coaches, almost none of them could name the running backs coach of the team they love. That's just it's a different element because there's no recruiting, because it's a different deal. All right. No matter if they coached 10 multi-thousand yard running backs and an NFL coach's career, that doesn't matter. They have no idea who the assistants are. In college football, they know them all by name, know their recruiting prowess, know their entire history, and freak out whether they're coming and going and how much money they make. All right. Well, so be it. If as long as it works for his players, whether it works for fans, media, or the like, fine. So be it. To the young men in the room who he coaches, if it works for them, outstanding. It certainly seems like it worked for people in the albeit brief time he was at Western Kentucky for a year. Seemed like it obviously worked for, whether it be Bucky Irving, Noah Whittington, who followed him from Western Kentucky out to Oregon, or Jordan James in his first 2 years here. Did it work for everybody? Maybe not. But we'll see. Now there's the back and forth, though, about that reference. Then there's this thing about, he likes being called Locke, and Dan here, there, or otherwise would call him by his first name, and that's a thing. Clearly, this is what was a very productive and good couple of years from Carlos Lachlan from a running back position output perspective. What was pretty good And recruiting, that you might be able to quibble with a little bit, particularly this past cycle. But, and all told, you had success with Bucky Irving. Things were pretty good. And Dan, last week, was quite complimentary. And also saying, it's an opportunity to get better, and you go and you try to do that. And fans can certainly feel they have with Rashad Samples. Time will tell.
For sure.
Things to now kind of get into this messiness through no one's fault but their own. You know, it's just for Lachlan to now be saying some of these things that's going to draw the ire of some Oregon fans these days. Well, that's it'll make it'll make this season's game a little bit more intriguing. It'll make our jobs easier. I wonder what we'll write about.
Live for the little drama, the little miniature dramas, right? But just on the point of like soft batch cookies or soft baked cookies or whatever it might be. I mean, I personally, just speaking to that, I prefer a cookie to be a little underdone than maybe an over.
So you are overcooked. So from Chips Ahoy, you want the chewies?
Yes, unquestionably. The dry ones, I mean, I had them in my lunch when I was a kid, but you know, those ones are more for convenience's sake than I think for quality. I'm more of an underbaked cookie person myself, setting aside all metaphors that might be there for calling someone soft or whatever your specific idea about masculinity and your decision making regarding your college football career.
Or professional cookie. Aspirations or anything
professional
else.
Professional aspirations. I just prefer an underbaked cookie. That's just my take.
More often than not, someone offers me a cookie, I'm not asking any questions thereafter. That may or may not be a problem, which is why
a cookie is a cookie. Yeah, that is a fair point.
Yeah, I try not to keep too many of them in the house to, know thyself, prevent, you know. don't keep the sweets around if you're going to stop, kind of thing. Though I have to admit, the Girl Scout cookies, that is a major weakness. That is a major weakness.
No doubt.
Hard to pass up. On a more serious note and the like, we'll shift gears. And again, we'll obviously be conversing about spring football and the like in the weeks ahead. And we'll get more into the defense and other stuff. And yes, we've heard from some defensive coaches and both Tasha Boy and Chris Hampton. And so we'll get to more. But believe me, we'll have more podcasts. But to shift gears to basketball, since last we spoke, obviously a really nice tournament run for Oregon men's basketball, reaching the second round and pushing it to double overtime with one of the great tandem performances in, not forget about program history or this year's tournament, probably in NCAA tournament history. And it shouldn't be lost to the annals and of box scores and select fan bases that what Jermaine Cousinard and Folly Dante did against Creighton in the second half and overtimes of that game, that should not just be lost to Oregon and Creighton fans. That was one of the most remarkable and bordering on outrageous performances from two men who put, I mean, you were talking about the proverbial, like going out on your shield, 37 of the last 39 points and taking nearly every shot and all, you know, the assists, the rebound, every which thing from the set, playing every minute, both of them.
Yeah, both of those guys. I mean, it was amazing. Like, it was, especially in Folly, given what he's, you know, given to the program over the years, you know, that tournament run for him felt like a love letter to Eugene, love letter to U of O in a lot of ways. And yeah, Cousinard was such a beast. Both of those games, just phenomenal. You know, being able to watch those remotely from Japan at strange hours of the day, I got a chance to take in those games, and it was remarkable. And I think a credit to Dana Altman, obviously, who's had his share of success in the tournament. But those two guys, man, wow! I mean, Dante and Cousinard, what an imprint that they, you know, they left on this program.
And again, had they won that game and beaten Creighton and gone to the Sweet 16, and it just basically had the outcome been ever so slightly different, and that whether Dante knocks down the free throw late in regulation, if the inbound didn't go to him in the first place and it went elsewhere, if they didn't foul early, like it was a messy final 90 seconds of regulation. But regardless, or had, for that matter, had Jermaine knocked down a shot that it was a difficult one, but you know, had they won on that, be it all as it may, it lives more in history because of the outcome if it's a victory, obviously. But that's why I say it should not be lost to the annals simply because it was a loss, because what they did was so extraordinary and so unheard of to see two guys put forth the stat line that they did in the second half and overtimes of that game was so, so obscene. It's just so, like I say, like in the course of watching it, I was going, I forget about what I had seen in person. That had long since eclipsed it. It was a matter of I had no awareness of any instance. And then after the game, seeing and, you know, for the statistical services and the like who put out and are able to compile it all, that know that at least in the last 25 years, there had never been anything like that. And then, you know, before that, stats are sometimes hard to come by in terms of quickly sorting through. But you know the history of the three-point line and shot clock and other things, and it's probably a pretty safe assumption that if it had happened before in either the 80s or 90s, it probably only happened once, if it happened at all. It may not have ever happened, what you saw from the two of them in the second half and overtimes of that game. That was that level of extraordinary. And it was really fitting for them. You wish for their sake that it had been a victory, because they deserve that much more attention and praise and positive emotions about what was a remarkable performance, but a heck of a run regardless. And we'll certainly hear from them in the not too distant future. I think about just, yes, this was the end of the seasons and the like, but you know what, where their futures are going to end up taking them and the like. Probably, I would imagine we may or may not hear from them, and hopefully sometime next week as the Oregon men's basketball staff make some adjustments, as well as Tony Stubblefield returns, which had been in the works for some time, basically from more or less from the day that that he was let go at DePaul. That was in the works. And alas, yes, Tony Stubblefield, who spent 11 years at Oregon and was obviously a terrific recruiter at Oregon, terrific recruiter not just alone, but with Mike Menica, who's still on the staff and is expected back as well. They were quite the duo on the recruiting trail, and to get them back together with a staff that still returns virtually everybody else as well.
A very well-kept secret there, it seemed.
Yeah, and there could be either more additions or adjustments and the like between Brian Fish had moved back to being a on-court and recruiting assistant this year. Last year, he was in a assistant role that was starting to morph, where the NCAA expanded the ability to have five assistants, three who would go on the road recruiting, two others who would not. So Fish was in a administrative role that was setting up for that. He went to a recruiting role this year in addition to the assistant. He could end up going back to, we'll see what that may entail for him. Kevin McKenna had already done that. We'll see. Again, Menega, his contract's up in June, but he's very much expected to be back. And it's now Stubblefield back. So Lewis Rowe's contract was up as of 10 days ago. And as of earlier this week, there had not been a move there. But I think some of it still has to do with bringing Tony back contractually and sorting out everybody's roles and some of that just getting shifted around while the transfer portal is very much underway. Brennan Rigsby and Kerry Oquendo going in. And we're still got a few more days of the portal being open here in college basketball. So we'll see if there's any additional movement. But it sounds like that could be it as far as Oregon men's basketball is concerned. On the women's side, after what was long since discussed and drilled home that it was a epically disappointing season and a poor run, obviously did not have any kind of postseason, that the departures were exactly, if you were to lose anybody from the roster that was, they were exactly who you did not want to lose, in that it was Grace Van Sluten and Chance Gray, Kennedy Basham leaving as well. Priscilla Williams had hopped in even a couple days before them. So the bottom line is for Oregon women's basketball, they are in a world of hurt by way of personnel right now. Yes, yeah, Peyton Scott comes off injury, and they had a transfer. So far, they've got one addition in one of the nation's leaders in steals, from Siena last year. But quite literally, it's Peyton Scott and their new incomer and, you know, Philly Shea at the moment and a couple of freshmen, and that's about it. There's not much else on the roster as of today. Again, lots of things that will be changing in the days and weeks ahead, as they will undoubtedly be adding via the portal.
Yeah, they have a lot of work to do in that portal, and there's a lot of, you know, talent out there for sure. You know, you think about, you know, players that might leave some of the more contending programs that are seeking more opportunities to be the player for a program. You know, if Oregon's program still has that cachet and elite players still want to come here, which, you know, given the way the last couple of years have gone, there is a question there for sure. There is an opportunity to improve your team right now, but right now it hangs in the balance, and you wonder, you know, which way the tides are going to turn for Kelly Graves and company, because obviously this was a brutal season, and we've gone on at length about the 14 straight losses, the awful result in the final game against Colorado in the Pac-12 tournament. But it does, I think, go deeper than that when you look at the trends of these players leaving the program and having success, like now national champion Tahina Paupau, who, you know, she was interviewed after that game when Dawn Staley in South Carolina went undefeated and got that national championship victory over Caitlin Clark in Iowa. She was interviewed about it, and she even mentioned that, you know, the program and its approach to winning and all everything else that went into it. Take note that maybe NIL was not mentioned in the interview, but that is certainly a factor for some of the athletes. I'm not saying necessarily in this situation, but the there are other programs around the country that have been in similar positions to the ones that Oregon was in a few years ago in the Ionescu years, that have retooled, rebuilt, or maintained their standing. And if Oregon wants to catch up to them, they're going to have to start probably backing up the Brinks truck a little bit for some of these high level transfers, because it's not going to magically come out of a recruiting class that is comparable to not terribly comparable to some of the better teams anyway. It's got to come through the portal.
Oh, and the bottom line is that this is not sustainable. What's happening to this program, to the Oregon women's basketball program, is not sustainable to have success doing this. Are there transfers everywhere? Yeah. Well, there's an average, if you go by the number of transfers, which is, again, continuing to go up and will continue to go up in the next few days as the portal window is open. Well, it's an average of 3 per program across 330 some odd Division I teams. Okay. But many of them are players who are looking for more playing time. They're players who didn't play. They're players, or if they did play, they didn't play particularly well. Their numbers are pretty poor. I'd say Priscilla Williams probably falls in that category. She wasn't cleared to play in the first place, got cleared to play mid-December. Her best game was her first game, and then her numbers did not, you know, were not terribly good. And then in the blowout that was the finale, she didn't even play. So she moves on. Well, there are lots of players, lots of programs who are moving on who are averaging less than 5 points, less than 3 points a game. You can understand that. There is not 3 players or 2 players per team. The top 2 scorers on a good team, bad team, or otherwise are not all leaving every team in the country. So when you're trying to go about building and correcting and righting the proverbial ship, to do that gets really, really, really hard to do when you have pieces that one might argue are the pieces you try to build around and you try to supplement via the portal. When you then lose those pieces year after year, what choice do you have but to try to stopgap and fill every hole that you've now created after the course of 4 years via the portal? because you're not going to, even if you did sign 12 freshmen, that doesn't work either. So you have to try to supplement. It's one thing to supplement. It's another thing to, it's the only thing you got. And right now, this women's basketball program has year after year lost its best players. Last year, it lost its two best players. This year, it's losing its two best players. That's not sustainable. I don't care who you go out and recruit. I don't care who you go off and sign from the transfer portal. You can't lose your two best players in successive years by their own actions, by their own decisions, not to the WNBA. You cannot lose your two best players to transfer back-to-back years and then say, oh, no, no problem, we'll reload. That's not a sustainable thing. Well, South Carolina won the championship with a whole new starting lineup. Yeah, they did. One, they're South Carolina. Two, they didn't stop recruiting.
Yeah, they had three, two starting lineups anyway, to be three, completely honest.
Right. And three, who did they add via the portal? The pick of the litter. They're going to, you know, there are places who are in a different advantageous position. You cannot go out and try to sustain success. I don't care if we're talking about men's basketball, women's basketball, whoever, what conference, mid-major, what, you can't sustain that. It's not going to work. And again, for the fans who are frustrated and want change and don't understand why there hasn't been change, but hey, you know, again, that's for others to answer for. All we can do is try to go ahead and provide the goings on in the transactional time of year that is here in the portal. So we'll certainly get into that more in the days and weeks ahead as we discuss more spring practice, and we'll get into more as the men's and women's basketball programs each add transfers in the days and weeks ahead, and then any changes to staffs and the like. We'll get to all of that, but we appreciate all of you for tuning in as always to the Ducks Confidential Podcast. A reminder, if you don't already do so, to like, subscribe, 5-star review, all those things. So that way you can get all of our episodes as well as the episodes of all of our other podcasts here on the Oregonian Sports Podcast channel and the like. And that will do it for us this week. We will see you again soon. For Ryan Clark, I am James Crepian. And again, we will chat with you again next week.